example. I set up an antenna that is 10 wavelengths wide. I divide 10 into 70, and I end up with a 7. In theory, an antenna that is 10 wavelengths wide will have a 7-degree beamwidth to it. Rough rule of thumb. So, you tell me how many wavelengths wide the antenna is, I'll tell you the horizontal beamwidth. Tell me how many wavelengths high is the antenna, aperture, I'll tell you what is the vertical beamwidth. So you can see that it takes real estate to make a antenna pattern. The gain of an antenna is really its pattern, directivity, so to say, assuming you've got 100% efficiency within the antenna. If the antenna's got 100% efficiency, then the directivity and gain means the same thing. Gain really means that the antenna is squirting the signal in one direction like a flashlight. You can say your antenna has got 10 dB of gain. You can say that in the direction that you're directing the antenna, the signal looks like it's 10 times stronger. That's what 10 dB of gain means. Let me drop. So if I'm comparing it to an isotropic antenna, like a light bulb that radiates in all directions, and I've now got that light bulb in the parabolic surface of a flashlight, and I'm taking the signal that would have been squirted in all directions, and I'm now squirting it into the main beam of this flashlight, so to speak, and I can easily make that flashlight beam 10 times stronger because of the way I've directed the signal. Did the antenna really make my 100-watt signal act like 1,000 watts? Did it increase the wattage of the signal by 10 to 1? Of course not. But since your basis of comparison is that numbers, which, by the way, turns out to be 0 dB over isotropic, and why does 1 equal 0 dB? We won't get into that one right now. But because you're squirting the signal in one direction, when you're in that direction, you see 10 times stronger signal than you would have ordinarily, and you say the antenna's got 10 dB of gain. But since you're not putting any real power into the antenna, you didn't give it 100 volts of B+ at 10 amperes, if you know what I mean, it doesn't have the ability to really multiply the signal. It's because the comparison you've used, the isotropic antenna, is the lowest gain antenna in the world that has 100% efficiency. As long as you're willing to use that as your comparison, then reasonable antennas will always have gain. See where it's coming from here. And the fractal has no magic about giving you that directivity unless the fractal has real estate. Coming back to the basics. NSYNC Zulu Papa. We're going to listen to you this time, John. K2RIW in the TechNet. Wait for the beep.
Okay. My main foray into the whole fractal idea was I have probably about 120 feet to play with to put up a dipole, and I was looking to go from 160 to 10 meters, if possible. Probably settle with just the 80 meters to 10. And I do have an SGC 230 tuner that I'd like to use. I'm just trying to figure out a way to put up an antenna that will give me my biggest bang for a buck. And that was, I think you've answered a lot of my questions there. And I'm going to definitely do some more research here. N6CT.
Yeah, once you study the fractal-like approach, it is my guess, John, that your chances of applying it on the 80-meter band and the 160-meter band is near zero. I think it's very unlikely you're going to apply it. As a VHF-UHF technique, it's kind of a fun thing to do. If I wanted to operate an antenna on every band from 160 meters to 10 meters, the biggest bang for the dollar would be a fan dipole. In other words, I got a real dipole there for 160, a real dipole for 80, a real dipole for 40, a real dipole for 20, 15, and 10, and any of the walk bands if you like. A real dipole, and separate them a little bit. The magic of a fan dipole is that on the resonant frequency, if I'm transmitting on 40 meters right now, that 40-meter dipole out of the fan, the one that's 65 feet long, has resonance. It will act like a 70-ohm impedance. 95% of your power will go into that antenna. The 80-meter antenna, which is at the exact same point of connection, is, at that instant of time, a 2,000-ohm impedance. It's an open circuit. No power, per se, will flow into the 80-meter dipole when the 40-meter dipole is there as part of the fan. The magic of the fan dipole, it is a automatic electronic switch. The radio signal decides, hey, that particular dipole on this frequency, I'm on 20 meters right now, the signal goes crawling down that feed line, it sees the 20-meter dipole, and he says, hey, that's a beautiful impedance match, I'm going to go down that one. The signal will go down the one that it resonates. That's got the reasonable impedance. All the others, in general, will be an open circuit. and no power goes there. So it's an automatic electronic switch. There are ways of building traps inside of a dipole to give it multiple frequencies. And tuning one of those, let me drop. Once you've got the real amount of capacitance to your particular tree, your particular altitude above the ground, and you now try to adjust the individual length between those traps and the individual tuning of the traps so that each one of your bands resonates on the center of the band if you want to. A trap dipole is a nice, simple way to go when you come to the final design. But getting that final design is a dog of a problem. Whereas with the fan dipole,
2 meter transmit.
The fan dipole is almost independent. When you're adjusting the 80 meter dipole, you're adjusting the visuar of the 80 meter antenna portion, and so on. So it's a rather simple antenna. The amount of interaction between them is relatively small, with a reasonable amount of separation at the tips, and with the right kind of a rope assembly up in the air, suspending all those individual insulators at those individual lengths is nowhere near as difficult as you think. So if you really want all of those bands in one antenna, it's going to be pretty hard to beat a fan dipole from my point of view. Mike, WY2U, is solving that kind of a problem for the field day site for his particular group as we speak. I talked to somebody who told me that Mike is working on some kind of a situation. Let's see how Mike, if you happen to be on frequency, Mike, tell us where you stand with that particular project. Whiskey Yankee 2 uniform, if you're there, and I hope you are. KCRIW in the TechNet.
UB2HWW with an important comment, Dick.
Howie, recognize that Mike first. Are you there, Mike? Okay. Howie, maybe you've built a fan dipole, and maybe you've had some good news or bad news. Go right ahead with your comment, Howie.
This fan dipole's in the past. I'm just going to make a comment. When you're making a fan dipole, you don't need a 15-meter dipole. Use your 40. Be careful that you don't have odd harmonics, because then pulp antennas are going to start working. So you probably want to have an antenna for 80, a dipole for 80, a dipole for 40, a 20, and a 10. You don't need the 15-meter dipole. And you do want to use a slight antenna tuner. Go ahead.
Yeah, that was Howie, and he made a very good point. And I failed to recognize the fact that when you feed a dipole at its resonant half-frequency length and frequency, so to speak, it is approximately a 70-ohm impedance in free space, reasonable diameter of wire. And by the way, you can find out the exact impedance of every antenna by looking at the Chapter 4 of Antenna Engineering Handbook, the so-called Brown and Woodward curves. Or you can go to the article I published on that exact subject by going to the website of Dr. Tom Williams, WA1MBA. You go to the website of Whiskey Alpha 1, Mike Bravo Alpha .org. You go to that website, and at the bottom of that page, you'll see dipole impedance matching or Yagi impedance matching by K2RIW. You open up that article, 1,500-word article that explains it with the two curves, the resistive curve and the reactive curve, and now any reasonable length of wire that you're going to use as a dipole or as a monopole, you know exactly what impedance you're going to get out of those curves and out of that article. So what Howie is telling you, let me drop, is that as you go from the fundamental frequency to the second harmonic, if I'm using an 80-meter dipole, 132 feet long, and I'm feeding it at 3.6 megacycles, it'll give me a beautiful impedance match. I go to twice the frequency, the 40-meter band, and it's almost an open circuit. But I go to three times the frequency. If we happen to have a ham band on three times the frequency, and we don't, it would come back into resonance. Antennas tend to re-resonate on a 1, 3, 5, 7, 9, 11, the odd harmonics, if you know what I mean. And if you study what's going on, the way the signals bounce back and forth, you see how it comes back in phase again, so to speak. So Howie's right. You don't have to build the 15-meter dipole. The third harmonic of the 40-meter dipole will give that to you. So the fan dipole just got simpler. But you've got a lot of knobs to play with very inexpensive materials and a lot of performance out of the fan dipole. You might have a question on that, because I know I'm shifting the road that you were going down, John. N6 Papa, Zulu Papa, K2LIW in the TechNet. That last transmission of yours, by the way, was nice and loud. And don't move, and wait for the beeps.
So if you wanted to have a 80 or 10 meter fan dipole
it's minimal, you would use 80, 40, and 10 in order to get benefit from the odd multiple. W2TTT. You've got it. W2TT, you've got it, though. And so let's see what John's got to say on this. N6 Zulu Papa, K2RIW.
Okay, thank you, Dick. The fan dipole is a possibility. I'm stringing between, right now I'm in a, what they call a Dutch colonial, and I'm stringing it to a pole in the back of the garage. So between my longest length, I probably got about 120 feet. And I don't know, I'd have to look at the different schemes to do a fan dipole, which is very interesting. And then to feed the fan dipole, would I have, I'm guessing I would have to use some kind of balloon to get it coax, or could I use a 450 lateral line, N6EP?
The reason why a person uses lateral line is either because he wants super low loss or because he's feeding an antenna that has super high standing wave ratio and he wants to impedance match it with an antenna tuner in the shack. If the antenna has a very high standing wave ratio and the antenna tuner is in the shack, you've got a lot of RF energy bouncing back and forth a whole lot of times on that transmission line. Therefore, the loss builds up real fast if it's not low loss line, like open wire line. In the case of the fan dipole, where you're going to have a very low visuar on each one of those bands, ordinary coax will work like a charm. On top of that, to build a balun, B-A-L-U-U-N or B-A-L-U-N, balanced to unbalanced structure, to build a balun for that fan dipole, a poor man's balun consists of a few turns of the coax cable held together with black tape right at the antenna. What happens with an antenna that doesn't have a balun is that if I feed the center conductor to the right side of a dipole and the shield to the left side, the signal flowing down the coax cable is perfectly shielded, all of it's inside the cable, until it hits the antenna. You and I think that dipole is one single antenna. Mother Nature says, no way, Jose, that is two separate monopoles. There's a quarter wave monopole to the right, a quarter wave monopole to the left. In your mind, you've combined the two and you call it dipole. That's two separate monopoles. If I'm trying to put 100 volts across that dipole in the center, Mother Nature tries to rebalance it. She tries to make 50 volts to ground on the right-hand side and 50 volts to ground on the left-hand side. In that process of Mother rebalancing that antenna, she will issue that 50 volts back down the outside of your coax cable. That's why you put a balun there, to stop the RF energy from heating up the cable, and now the cable becomes part of the resonating system. That's not always...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
It's not always bad. It's not a showstopper. Lots of us have done that. It doesn't catch on fire. It doesn't do anything really bad, except that if that coax cable goes by your neighbor's apartment in your apartment building, you're probably going to light up their television set because the cable is hot. The outside of the cable is hot. In some cases, if you're using a D104 metal-cased microphone in a shack and you got enough RF energy flowing down the outside of the cable, you walk up to that microphone and you get a spark that jumps between it and your lip. The shack becomes hot. So putting in the right kind of a balun, and you can buy lots of baluns, or you can make a poor man's balun out of coax cable. The coax cable coiled together is an RF choke. The RF energy is being issued on the outside of the cable, but the RF choking action means that very little that flows but beyond those coils of coax, and very little that flows down the rest of the cable, if you know what I mean. So there's a fairly simple solution to that one once you understand why a balun is required. And I wish more people had it explained to them, if you know what I mean. It's kind of a mystery type thing, but now you maybe know a little bit more about why it's required, John. You're asking a darn good set of questions. I know quite a few people who listen to us quite often need this kind of info. N6 Zulu Papa, K2RIW on the TechNet.
Yes, K2RIW. I also have another question that I guess pertains to this. The house that I'm in has also got aluminum siding, so I know ladder line is going to be difficult to use anyway. I asked about the ladder line because I do have a manual tuner which has input outputs for both, I guess. But I have lots of coax, too, which I can use. And I asked someone else this question. They didn't seem to think that it was going to matter too much, having the coax up against the side of the house there, but I'm thinking it will couple someone, and that's part of the question there, too. Back to you, Dick.
The good news, John, glad you asked this one, is when coaxial cable is proper, run it under the rug, around the door jamb, alongside of the metal siding of the house, through the screen door, any way you want to. Assume that the coax cable is a perfectly shielded structure, as long as you're not exceeding the manufacturer's specifications for minimum bend radius. Well, you could do some internal damage if you try to bend it real, real sharp. Other than that, you can run it anywhere you want, as long as it is properly balanced. I will admit that if you didn't put a balun at the end of the coax cable and you just dumbly connected it to a dipole, shield to one side and center conductor to the other side, and now a significant amount of RF energy is crawling back down the outside of the coax, now as the wind blows and it slaps up against the aluminum siding of the house, you will get what looks like detuning of the antenna, simply because what you think is the dipole of the antenna is really dipole plus coax cable, also as part of a radiating system, if you didn't use a balun. With the right kind of a RF choke / balun structure at the antenna, the outside of the cable is always cold. Lay it against anything you want. If it was hardline, you could lay it underwater, underground, against metal structures, against the ductwork, and so on. So the coax cable, properly used, is a perfectly shielded structure. Put it anywhere you want. Back to you, John, K2LIW.
Okay, so if I make the poor man's balloon out of the coax, how many turns and what diameter should I be using?
I could either give you a fish or I could teach you how to go fishing on this one, John. If you go to the first or second chapter of the Radio Amateur's Handbook, there's an equation in there where you tell the equation the number of turns of wire and the diameter of those turns. It will tell you how many microhenries or microhenries of inductance it has. Once you know the number of microhenries, you go to the other chart that's in there that'll tell you this number of microhenries at 80 meters has this number of ohms of reactance, like say for instance 400 ohms. Because it's a 50 ohm system, and if you give it enough turns at your particular frequency so that it has enough microhenries, so it has enough inductive reactance, that's what we're talking about, and if those number of ohms of inductive reactance is high compared to 50 ohms, then it's starting to become an open circuit. 400 ohms would probably be pretty good. 4,000 ohms would be a hell of a lot better. And that's some number of turns of some number of inches or feet of diameter of the wire. The coax cable, the outside of the coax cable, as far as the choking action is concerned, is simply a fat piece of wire, if you know what I mean. And the fact that on the inside of it is a center conductor and the rest of the coax, the choking action doesn't know that. It keeps the two things separate. The shield of the coax keeps what's going on inside and what's going outside thoroughly separate, and you can treat them independently. Ain't that nice, John? Back to you, K2RIW.
Okay, yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And I am going to go back to the handbook there. Now, I know this is probably a silly question, but I know if I coil it like a regular inductor, where the coils are parallel next to each other, what is the difference if I were to coil it in a spiral? I know it would have to change somewhere, and I know that probably the outside turns would probably create a different inductance. Is there any pluses or minuses to doing something like that? Back to you.
Yeah, lots of people have built a balun like this. Most people, by the way, pronounce it balun, not balun. The A is not a long A. That's the way most people pronounce it, John, balun. Almost everybody makes those turns for the poor man's balun, the choke, and they lay them right up against each other and tape it all together. You could spread it out like a spiral if you wanted to. When you take a coil and spread it out, the inductance goes down. You want as much inductance as you can get. you might start then worrying about what about the capacitive coupling between the individual turns. When you study that enough, you'll find it's an extremely minor factor. Reasonably sure you're going to take, oh, let me pick it, a number, 1.5 foot or so diameter of coax cable. You're going to end up on 3 or 4 turns of it taped together, and that might be good enough. And you're going to make zero spacing between the turns, you know, the outer polyethylene jacket, polyvinyl chloride jacket, right up against each other. And the amount of capacitive coupling between the turns, it's an extremely minor factor. Don't worry about it. Let me drop. When you're trying to make an inductor that has extremely broadband characteristics and no real resonance within the inductor itself, then you are going to spread it out a little bit like a spiral, and you're going to change the diameter of the turns. It's going to be a conical spiral. If you want super broadband of a choke, you don't need that. But if I was trying to design a choke that went from 0.5 megacycle to 100 megacycles inclusive, I would probably end up with a conic-shaped spiral-wound choke, if you know what I mean. Now I've got a distributed kind of inductance that's changing in diameter as it goes along the length, and if I do it just right, I can avoid many of the intermediate resonances of that structure. I can make an RF choke cover multiple octaves and maybe even multiple decades. You do not need that. Put that in your hip pocket. That's something you might need someday, John. Back to you. You're asking some darn good questions. N6 Zulu Papa, K2RIW.
Yeah, all the information you've given so far is wonderful. In fact, this is probably the best tech net or any net I've ever heard before. And I think that you know, I'll let you keep going on everyone else's questions there, but because I have a lot of information here I have to dig into, and I really appreciate it. It's a big help. Answered a lot of questions I've had lingering for the last 20 years or so. But I really appreciate it. But thank you, K2RIW, N6ZP, and Valen. I forget how to say things. So thank you.
Hey, John, sounds like we've got a happy customer there. Looks like I have to send him a bill. That was a joke. Stop worrying, John. John, I just talked to you. Now, John, number one, K6WGB, time for you to go to your the mailbag, the Mel's Corner, as it used to be called, K2, in honor of K2KEY, who did that function for us for about 6 years. KC2WGB, K2RIW.
Good evening again, Dick, and everybody on the net. Yes, and he did a wonderful job at it, so very helpful. Very much appreciated. Let me let him drop, and I'll proceed with the question.
A check-in until we go. Glad to hear from you. That's the man in the hospital. Boy, he sounds good. He's faking it. He's making it believe he's sick. He's in the hospital, and he's collecting all that money there, all of those contributions. Glad to hear from you, Rich. John, to get it, KC2WGB, K2RIW.
Good evening, Rich. I hope everything's going well with you over there. Sounds like it is. And I've been watching your device on eBay. I didn't see any hits on it yet, so I don't know if you've been keeping track, but I just thought I'd let you know. You let it drop. Okay, we have a young man named Leonard. Now, he's got a question, AM versus FM. He is just getting his start, and he is experienced with CB 11 meters, and he noticed how noisy AM is, and he listens on his scanner to the FM frequency, such as this one. And he wants to know why they don't put the devices in the AM radio so that it sounds as good as the FM radio. Maybe you could give him a fast rundown on that, Dick, on the construction and methods of modulation and why it is so quiet, the FM, compared to AM. KC2WGB, back to you, Dick.
Yeah, the early days of spark gap and the early days of the slow switchover from spark gap transmitters to crystal control transmitters is that once you emit a high-frequency sine wave signal, 3.5 megacycles if you're on the 80-meter band, or 28 megacycles if you're on a 10-meter band, once you create that high-frequency sine wave, couple it to a good antenna, it's called the carrier, that radio wave will go through space, it can be easily received at a long distance away with the right kind of receiving equipment, and now you know the signal is there. Turn that signal on and off, mix it with a beat frequency oscillator, turn it into tones, and we call it Morse code. But the bottom line is, the real magic of radio is the radio carrier, the sine wave. That's what really propagates. Once you decide that the sine wave is there, you now want to put information on it. You can thoroughly turn it on and off. We call that Morse code. A1 key down Morse code, if you know what I mean. But when you want to transmit voice on that signal, you have to change it in some way that conveys the voice. And you basically have two techniques. Angular modulation or amplitude modulation. Those are the only two things you can do with that carrier. You can change its amplitude in all kinds of complicated ways, or you can change its frequency in all kinds of ways. With the frequency modulation is in general to a real serious engineer called angular modulation. So you're going to make the frequency slash phase go up and down. That's called the angular modulation techniques. Or you're going to make the amplitude go up and down, stronger and weaker. We call that amplitude modulation. And there are various techniques by which you can combine the two. 16 quadrature amplitude modulation, 16 QAM, is one of the digital techniques that combines the two. The good news about FM radio, let me drop, is that if I'm modulating the frequency of the carrier generator, which might be a crystal oscillator way back in the beginning of the transmitter, and I'm making that frequency go up and down a little bit with a variable frequency oscillator, and it goes through that whole chain of the transmitter and out the final stage and out the antenna. The good news about FM modulation is with 1 milliwatt of audio, I can FM modulate that crystal, and I am now modulating a 1,000 watt or a 10,000 watt or a 1,000,000 watt transmitter. 1 milliwatt of audio can do it with angular modulation. That's the good news. And another piece of good news is if I've got a real good FM receiver with a real good discriminator and limiter circuit in there, it gives you some pretty good hi-fi sounding signals. It's pretty good at canceling static and gives a pretty nice round sound to music and whatever. Those are good news. The bad news is that FM modulation is expensive on bandwidth. The FM modulation that sounds so beautiful on your broadcast radio, 88 to 108 megacycles, each one of those channels is 200 kilohertz wide. The actual transmitter itself is modulating peak to valley 150 kilohertz of width. You and I, as a ham radio operator, could put 150 guys in there, each 1 kilohertz spaced, and that FM modulator has one single signal occupying 150 kilohertz. There are two disadvantages of that. Let me drop. One, it's a real frequency hog, but as long as you've dedicated a high power transmitter and a nice frequency allocation, as the FCC did between 88 and 108 megs, you use that properly with the right kind of equipment, it's a beautiful sound that comes out of that radio. However, when you build a receiver that's 150 kilohertz wide to absorb that signal, it has a hell of a lot less threshold. The weakest signal it can listen to is 15 or 20 dB worse than if you had a receiver that was only 1 kilohertz wide, so to speak. So FM has got this peculiar characteristic that if you set it up as wideband FM, it's got some beautiful noise immunity, but you need more transmit power to cover the same range because the receiver is less sensitive. Narrowband FM corrects a little bit of that, but now narrowband FM, for a bunch of complicated reasons, is much more noise vulnerable. Yeah, narrowband FM has less noise to it than pure AM, but it has nowhere near as good a threshold. If I now compare narrowband FM to single sideband, the single sideband is probably at least 10 and maybe 15 decibels more sensitive for the same frequency region and the same bandwidth compared to narrowband FM. Narrowband FM has got this nice noise-canceling characteristic if and only if, let me drop, if and only if the signal is the right number of decibels above threshold or the minimum signal that this receiver can tolerate. Above that threshold, FM has got some nice noise-canceling characteristics. As the signal-to-noise ratio gets lower than, let me pick a number, 6 decibels, as it approaches 0 dB of signal-to-noise ratio, to a Morse code operator, that's a beautiful signal. To a narrowband FM receiver, that's a terrible signal. It'll give you a whole lot of hash in the background. And it crashes after that. A little bit of lessening of the signal strength on the FM receiver, and all of a sudden the noise comes up real fast. So you pay your money, you take your choice. FM has got some characteristics that are very desirable for channelized communication to a taxi cab, we'll say. Single sideband has got some beautiful characteristics for very weak signal reception, like moon bounce and DX operations. And single sideband used correctly can also create great high fidelity because of the way we use it with speech processing and receivers that are less than ideal in the way they're tuned. Single sideband sometimes it takes getting used to the Donald Duck sound, if you know what I mean. So each modulation technique has its pros and cons. What's the best possible way of doing it? Well, it depends on what frequency region, how many miles you've got to cover, how many watts you're willing to dedicate, how big is the antenna going to be, how sensitive do you want the receiver. There's a bunch of variables involved. And so the modern-day digital techniques are tending to use a combination of angular modulation and amplitude modulation, and the one I gave you as an example, 16-QAM, is one of them. This is far from the whole story. And you'd be amazed how many guys who, in their senior year in college, studying electrical engineering, will do a fairly deep study of all the advantages and disadvantages and exact thresholds.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
All the advantages, disadvantages, and the exact thresholds and ranges that you can get out of FM versus AM versus FM. Single sideband is one of the kinds of AM. FM, narrowband FM, phase modulation, those are the kinds of angular modulation. And so, I, for one, in my senior year, did a report on the advantages and disadvantages of those. As you can tell from the fact that it was a senior year college project, means that for the average person, it's not quite as simple as it first would sound. I know that's not all of the information, but at least it's some of it, John. KC2, WGB, K2RIW.
Oh, very good, Dick. No, I'm sure there's a lot of information there he'll be able to use. Because I know basically what he's wondering is, as you know, when you're listening to AM or the 11-meter band and you have lightning in the area, you hear it. Where on the FM, it's quite subdued. So that's one of his issues. But I'm sure he has a good handle on it now. And he can follow that down by following some AM and FM information on Wikipedia or one of those things. That's very good. Now let me drop. We'll go on to the next one.
Yeah, I'm going to add a couple words to that. Stand by a second. In the early days of television broadcast in the United Kingdom, the audio that went along with the picture was amplitude modulated. As such, the Brits came up with some very good circuits for amplitude modulation, noise cancellation. Call them static clipping circuits or whatever. So with the right kind of a noise blanker circuit added to your AM receiver, a high percentage of the noise that's very annoying to you can be 98% eliminated. The best receiver I know of was the Drake R4C with the auxiliary noise blanker circuit. Many of the more modern Drake receivers have a noise blanker that is 95% as good as that one. So real good noise blankers. And by the way, the word noise blanker, it's sort of like the word high fidelity. It's a very relative word. There are people who just put a simple diode in the audio circuit and they call it a noise clipper. But a well-designed noise blanker circuit which can recognize the signature of the beginning of the spike of noise and blank the receiver for that microsecond of duration and then come back out of the blanking mode without making auxiliary glitches in the audio. A real good noise blanker circuit can make tremendous improvements in the noise that you hear on an AM radio. So before you give up on AM, consider real good noise blankers. KC2WGB, K2RIW.
Yes, don't give up, that's for sure. And also there were the noise inverters, which took the noise signal, inverted it, and applied it against the incoming, and also canceled the noise. Very effective. Worked well, especially in sync circuits. I know also where we were having trouble here in America with that kind of stuff. All right, we're going to drop. We'll go on to the next one. Okay, we have this young parent ham already up with a question. He's really kind of tired with the older hams talking about the Collins equipment and all these marvelous things they had in the past. His honest belief is that a medium price for today has better selectivity and sensitivity than those old boat anchors. And he'd like your opinion on that because he feels he's right. Over to you, Dick. KC2WGB.
If this was the 1975 time frame, maybe the 1965, but 1970-75 time frame, and if I looked around as to who made Volkswagens and Buicks and Cadillacs in the radio world, in that time, Collins was the Cadillac or the Rolls-Royce. It had a permeability-tuned oscillator. It had this crystal lattice filter. What was it called? I can't think of the name of the acoustic filter. It had a an ultrasonic 8.9 megacycle filter, very elaborate circuit with a beautiful shape to it, very little ring and so on. So they put some extremely high technology into the filter, the oscillator stability, the tuning, the dynamic range, the intermodulation distortion, the third order intercept point. In its day, it looked like a Cadillac. It acted like a Cadillac. It tuned like a Rolls-Royce. It was smooth, heavy, big, expensive, and boy, it worked. And so a significant number of ham radio operators who cut their teeth at that time fell in love with that brand, and that love affair has not attenuated all these years. You take a guy who was doing ham radio at that time, and you put him into the 2012 flea market, where he sees a shiny Collins radio at one end of the table. It'll draw him like a magnet. Oh, boy. He remembers those days when he couldn't afford it, and he wished he could have one. Let me drop it. But now a more objective person takes a modern-day radio which has digital signal processing, which can make a filter that is even better than that very elaborate crystal filter, that the lattice filter, I can't think of the name of the darn thing, but Collins had a very fancy filter. With digital signal processing, you can find a better filter. By digital processing signal to noise ratio techniques, you can tune out individual undesired signals. You can shape the passband. You can do all kinds of optimization techniques. Modern-day, well-made, synthesized radios have got frequency stability. That permeability-tuned oscillator in the Collins radio was by far the most stable thing on the planet in its day. A modern-day phase lock loop can put it to shame. A modern-day digital signal processor can put the filter to shame. I don't know if the modern-day receivers are any higher in dynamic range, but if you're willing to pay the money, there's a way you can get that. So you buy the right brand name of modern-day radio. It has got a hell of a lot more horns and whistles. It's got a lot more frequency stability. It's got a lot more adaptability characteristic. It's a hell of a lot smaller, lighter, efficient. And so an objective person today, in my opinion, will probably not buy a Collins. He's doing it for nostalgia reasons, because it has great value among his fellow old-fashioned ham radio operators. But if you're doing an objective search today and you choose the right brand name of modern-day radio versus Collins, I think 97% of the time you're not going to choose the Collins. That's an opinion. You find a Collins lover, and he will want to shoot me for saying those words. KC2WGB, K2RIW.
KC2WGB, yes, and they would shoot me too, because I do agree with that. I think they are more selective and are more sensitive than the older stuff, and a little easier to work. I agree. The nostalgia is there, and the equipment is beautiful. It was well made, and a lot of engineering went into it. But it's past its time. Still useful. Still used today. But I agree with you there, Dick. Let me let it drop. We'll go on to one more.
I'm going to throw in one other comment. I lived through the period of time of the Vietnam War. I was working as a guy with a security clearance and therefore a draft deferment during the Vietnam War, and I'm working on radio circuits that were trying to support that war. And some extremely expensive radios were created for that warfare field to give communication. And many of them failed like crazy. And you'd be amazed how many times the warfare officers said, give me something that's reliable. And they went out and bought Collins ham radio equipment, made some minor modifications to adapt it to the military frequencies, shipped them to Vietnam, and used them, and they worked like a charm. Better than the things that were being produced for a military contract at 10 times the cost. So in that particular day, in that environment, Collins made a really tough radio. Over to you, John. K2LIW.
Yeah, that is an environment that is very hard to design for. There are so many parameters. It's really tough on the engineers. But you're right. I mean, there are Collins radios I've seen that were brought back with bullet holes in them, and they were still operational. It's just great stuff. But I think it's past its time in the state today. KC2WGB. Let me go on to the next one. Let me let it drop. Okay, here I have a gentleman with a propagation question with submarine communication. Wonders if there is a Doppler shift in the transmission in salt water and through the varying temperatures and salinity of the water. If you know anything about that, he'd like to hear about that. Over to you, Dick.
When it comes to the sonar signals, the acoustic signals that are sent through the water, boy, the experience and all kinds of refocusing effects because of the water coming in different layers of temperature, different layers of salinity. You can easily locate a submarine below a particular salinity or temperature layer, and the submarine becomes somewhat invisible from a surface vessel that is trying to find that submarine by sonar. So acoustically, the water can do all kinds of funny things. A radio wave propagating through salt water is so extremely inefficient that until you operate at very low frequencies with antennas that are very close to the surface, you do not communicate by radio through salt water. You and your fellow submarine, your submarine and another submarine, could be 1 mile apart, and you're both 300 feet below the surface. And if you think you're going to send a radio wave through that environment, and the guy on the other end, a mile away, or maybe 10 miles away, is going to hear you by radio through that salt water, I think it's almost impossible, with a couple of rare exceptions. Now, so to talk about radio propagating through salt water, and if you're talking about a couple of feet of salt water, because you're operating the antenna within a couple of feet of the surface, and then that signal has to go through a little bit of salt water and then get launched into air. Yes, you can talk about that. But from, let me pick a number, 300 feet below the surface, can you send out a radio wave that anyone else at any reasonable range is going to hear it? I think the answer is almost perfectly no. Once you study the conductivity of salt water, it is so much of a short circuit to that antenna. To launch a wave into it is extremely difficult.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Why?
Joe recognized, once you launch that wave, it's very difficult to launch it, but once you launch it, that radio wave is going through a volumetric resistive material that's not too different from dirt, except that it's got higher conductivity and a higher loss tangent. If I try to put an antenna 300 feet below the ground on reasonable soil and radiate a signal from that antenna, unless I'm down at extremely low frequencies, which make the radio wave think it's only a small fraction of a wavelength to the surface, and the wire itself is going to be a mile long. That was the Project Sanguine, which was a kind of a communication circuit set up across the state of Michigan, which is intended to communicate with submarines at very low frequencies. Except for that kind of an exception, an antenna underground behaves very poorly. An antenna underwater behaves a hell of a lot more poorly. I won't say it's impossible. I'm going to say it is so extremely difficult that you and I, John, are very unlikely to get involved with it. I don't think we can make anything very useful about an antenna at any reasonable length below seawater. That's a bunch of opinions based on what I know and what has been experimented with in the past. There may have been some crazy way that some guy did it, but it's going to be at such a low frequency that the rate of communication is going to be so extremely slow that the average ham radio operator is probably not going to be interested in it. But it sounds like Joe's got a question on this. W-A-2-R-Y-Y. K-2-R-I-W. Go ahead, Joe.
On this exact subject you talk about. Recently I have seen divers use some sort of communication gear in case with a mask or helmet mask assembly, and it enables them to talk. I'm not sure the distance they talk from point to point underneath water, but they are using some sort of system that uses a way of transmitting human voice from diver to diver. Would you happen to know the medium that they're using?
I would put 95% of my money on saying that that was an acoustic technique, Joe. Whether it be direct audio or ultrasonic, quite possibly ultrasonic, but audio. If I'm sending a sound wave through water, and that sound wave through water propagates at, I forget what the number is, but it's a real fast velocity, 2 or 3 times as fast as it goes through air. So sound in water. You and I know that whales, for instance, can communicate with each other acoustically through many, many miles of water at reasonably low acoustic frequency. So I think when you investigate that that mask-to-mask diver communication, I think you're going to find that it's acoustic and not radio. Underwater radio, I think, is that antenna thinks it's looking into almost a dead short circuit, is my belief. Back to you, Joe. Where did you see that article? W-2-R-Y-Y, K-2-R-A-W.
It was something I was just watching on one of these PBS channels or something like that. And I happened to have a couple of divers going down. They were exploring a certain part of the ocean, I think it was Bahamas or something like that. They were looking for sharks or something like that, some sort of a whale shark or something like that. And they had a communication gear encased within the helmet. They were talking to each other underwater, and it's kind of pretty clear what they were replaying.
Wesley recognized. What makes me assume that it's acoustic, though, is that I know that seawater is worse than dirt, and the best example I can give you of how difficult it is to send a radio signal through dirt, and there's no more greater need for a radio signal below dirt than there is in the subway system of any of our major cities, Toronto, New York City, Los Angeles, and whatever. You've got subway systems, and you want to communicate through the dirt of those subway systems. And in every one of those systems, they're either laying fiber optic cable down the tunnels, and or they're laying Andrew Heliac's leaky coaxial cable. You have to have, in the case of the Andrew Heliac's cable, you could say it's got an antenna on the side of the cable every 2 inches, you could say, during miles and miles of the cable. The fact that they had to, with great difficulty and cost, they had to string all of these Andrew Radiac's cables down all of those tunnels in order to establish radio communication, tells me that there's a pretty strong piece of evidence there that there's no other way to get that signal to go through dirt. And the seawater, I think, is 10 times more lossy than dirt. So I think it's almost impossible to send a radio signal through any reasonable amount of dirt at any reasonable frequency. Now, if I make the radio wave go down to 10 kilohertz of radio, where it starts taking on some other characteristics, as long as I'm willing to build an antenna that's a mile long, maybe I can make some radio propagate. And people will argue with me as to whether or not that's acoustic or whether it's radio. Well, in one case, it is a transverse electromagnetic wave. I call that radio. In the other one, it is a longitudinal wave, which I call audio. And maybe I can get some cross-coupling between the two. So Maybe you know of ways of sending radio through seawater or dirt, Wes. N2XJN, K2RIW.
Well, electromagnetic waves in ELF frequency from 3 to 300 hertz penetrate seawater to the depth of 100 meters. Two systems, one was CIFR, which was the U.S. Navy, and the other one was GIPS. The first one operated 76 hertz, though the other one at 82 hertz, which basically we try to measure the wavelength would be around 3.5 kilometers, which would be one of the quarter of the Earth diameter. So that is one of the waves. So grant to submarine one way is one of the way that you drop, and one of the ways that is being done is that you take a huge site and then you put two huge electrodes in the ground at different sites and then feed the lines to them from the station that is in the middle, and that will form I don't know how to say it. But that is, we're talking about 60 kilometers distance. That was the Russian one in Murmansk. So that's my comment in here. The one that was made in Michigan was 52 kilometers, which was 32 miles. And this antenna wasn't very much efficient. And to XGS.
So Project Sanguine apparently was 52 kilometers in Michigan. And in that case, you don't care so much about efficiency. Well, they did use a megawatt-type transmitter to just barely get a signal to a submarine anywhere in the world at 60 feet below the surface. And so I guess you're saying these other systems worked at 76 hertz and 82 hertz. When you're on that lower frequency, you need miles of antenna. You need megawatts or kilowatts at least, or megawatts of power. And the signal you're sending is so extremely slow in information content that the average ham radio operator is not going to be interested in. Now, Wes mentioned one other thing. If I've got two ground rods in the ground with a large enough spacing between them, and it might be miles, and I set up a voltage field between the two, and then a couple of miles away I get another guy doing a similar thing to do reception, you're now using the resistive characteristic of the Earth a little bit like a potentiometer. You're converting the Earth into one great big potentiometer, and you could be sending a signal. That is a... let me drop. By the same token, I could have a great big large rubber sheet, slightly conductive rubber sheet, and across two of the corners... I present a voltage. Across the other two corners, I've got a receiver, and by resistive coupling techniques, like a great big potentiometer, I can send a signal. Is that a radio signal? No, not necessarily. I can send DC, if you know what I mean, direct current. I can put 5 volts across my two terminals, and the guy is going to get 5 millivolts across his two terminals, and it's going to deflect his oscilloscope. He's going to say, yeah, that's a 1, and now he's sending a 0. So you can convert the Earth into a potentiometer. That's neither radio nor acoustic, from my point of view. And there's various ways of doing it. So I think the bottom line is it's very unlikely that we're going to be sending substantial frequency radio signals through seawater or through dirt.
Colin?
Go ahead, Wes.
Interesting fact you just mentioned. In 1998, I presented to Army Rangers in Columbus, Georgia, the concept. That time I was working with resonance acoustical providing systems, which was able to retrieve the underground data to the depth of 2 kilometers. And we noticed one thing. When we put the piezoelectric foil in form of the sensor on the surface of the Earth, let me drop. And then I use my finger to tap next to the vicinity of the sensor. The amplitude of the signal that was coming from below the surface amplifies about 10,000 times. And we've been using the natural vibration of the Earth. We didn't know why is it happening, what is causing that. But I came to the conclusion that if Earth happened to be, instead of the typical thinking, very much sensitive to the vibration, we could use that as a telephony device. And I was doing that speech over 200 scientists or civilian and military scientists, and then after that I had a great response to that. So basically they proposed a building, repeaters that will actually sense the coded data and then retranslate that. From that, it was like the typical distance was about 2 to 5 miles till to the next transponder and to exchange.
So as long as I'm willing to make the string of repeater systems every 2 to 5 miles, I can, by that method, do communicating. A little bit different than normal ham radio, but a military setup in a certain environment might consider that a solution. I see what's going on there. Although I see a little bit of what's going on. Okay, I'm giving a fairly pessimistic answer to that particular question, as you can tell, John. Radio waves and seawater are a very tough combination. They're fairly incompatible. KC2WGB, what's the next one? K2RIW on the TechNet.
KC2WGB, yeah, and I can understand why he's asking the question, questioning the Doppler shift and if it's happening at all. Tough issue, good question. That's it from Mel's Corner, so we can proceed to Paul if you wish. KC2WGB, back to you, Dick.
Okay, thank you, John. Paul, WS2N, what's NASA been doing this week? And I hope that Curiosity is getting ready for its, I think it's August 8th, is its touchdown on Mars. WS2N, K2RIW.
I thought it was August 5th, but I'll have to double check. I forgot from last week. But very good. Just not really that much. I remember talking about a spacecraft a long time ago when it launched in 2004, called the Rosetta. I don't know if you remember that spacecraft. That's one that's going to a comet, and it was a European Space Agency spacecraft, not a NASA spacecraft. You know, it was launched from South America, French Guiana, or from an Ariane 5 rocket, a big rocket. But thought I'd just bring that up. You've got a lot of missions that are on their way, and then finally they're going to get to where they're going. You know, you've got New Horizons, which we've got a couple more years before that gets to Pluto. I think that's 2015. And you've got, of course, Curiosity coming up in a couple of months in August, early August. But you've got this Rosetta, which was launched many years ago. It's a 10-year flight out to this comet. Let me drop it. It's a big spacecraft. It's like a box shape. If you looked at it, it's like 10 by 10 by 10, and it's got a long, very long solar panel because it's going to be many AU from the Earth to go to this comet. And this comet is named after two Russians. I can't pronounce the name, but if you want, I could give you the information on that. But it's going to be going out to this comet, and it'll be the first time a spacecraft orbits a comet. And not only will it orbit, it's got a lander on board that will send the lander down and land on this comet. and send information back to them. The land is good for at least a week, maybe a couple of months. The orbital spacecraft, Rosetta, I mean, the reason it's got these big solar panels on is because this comet has quite an elliptical path. It'll come into around 3 AU and go all the way out to 6, and quite a change. And when you're all the way out there at 6, you're going to have around 400 watts on the panels. And when you're close, around 3.4, they say, is 850 watts capability.